Someday, there was a memorial service for Bill W. in the cathedral in Bristol, and it began with the Dean of Bristol saying some prayers of remembrance. Then the preamble was read, and then the opening of chapter 5 of the big book with the reading of the steps. And after that, Bob H. spoke about his memories of Bill.
I've been asked to speak here today about Bill. But since I can speak of him only as I knew him, this will have to be essentially a personal remembrance. I saw Bill for the first time at my first AA meeting. He stood tall, and there was something about him, a magnetism perhaps, that set him apart from the rest of us. When I needed help a few weeks later, it was to him I turned. I went down to his office on Busy Street to see him, and he took an hour out of his busy day to share his experience, strength, and hope with me. He did more. He made a phone call and got me the sponsor I so badly needed. That was in 1942. A few years later, the future was much on Bill's mind. AA's future, that is. He seemed unconcerned about his own. The rest of us talked of the future too, but for us, this was only tomorrow. He looked into the decades ahead. Even then, planning for the day when he would no longer be with us. AA could have been his movement. He chose to give it to us. He could have continued to make all the decisions, but he stepped aside so that we could make them ourselves. By so doing, he assured our future. For from these acts of love and humility, the General Service Conference was born. But not even that came easily. Bill had to fight for it. Fortunately for all AAs, Bill was a fighter. Make no mistake about that. What else was he? This man to whom so many owe their lives. Did any of us really know him? No matter. When we were with him, we knew we were in the presence of greatness. Visionary, realist, fighter, conciliator. He was all of these. And one thing more. He was, I think, a man inspired by God. I had the privilege of working with Bill in 1952. The year 1968 brought me a second chance to work with him at our General Service office. He seemed much the same to me, a little older perhaps, but then so were we all. He never offered advice gratuitously to us in the office, but his door was always open. I remember his warmth and laughter especially. A year ago last spring, for the first time really, it dawned on us that Bill was mortal. We had always taken him so much for granted. None of us who were in Miami in the summer of 1970 will ever forget what he did for us there. When he rose from wheelchair to lectern, he was a commanding presence once more. His voice vigorous, his humor intact, he was, for those few minutes, the Bill we had always known. What that effort cost him, we shall never know. As the summer faded into the fall, I think we all knew, really, that Bill would not be with us for long. Bill needs no encomiums from us, no monuments of stone or steel. He will live in our hearts and in the fellowship he left behind him. I can think of no better way to conclude this brief remembrance than with Bill's own words. Regardless of worldly success or failure, regardless of pain or joy, regardless of sickness or health, or even of death itself, a new life of endless possibilities can be lived if we are willing to continue our awakening.
Here's the last public address made by Bill, Miami Beach, Florida, July 1970.
To introduce to you our chairman for this meeting, Dr. Jack.
We have a tremendous thrill. Our prayers have been answered. Bill is here and will be coming on.
A vision for you. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your thoughts to Him and to yourself. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. And you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Let us pray. Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy. O divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive, it is in pardoning that we are pardoned, and it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. Amen.
This was a memorial service held for Bill in Bristol, England.
But we will now hear again from the founder of our great organization, Bill Wilson.
Good morning, dear people. I would like to renew the thanks that Lois gave for the privilege of being with this magnificent crowd. We have heard unsurpassed talks on every aspect of that benign, that providential synthesis, which is our society. We have seen and felt and heard expressions of its spiritual essence, of its moral substance. We are reminded that our malady was lack of life in the spirit, lack of morality. But lest we get too guilty, we are also happily reminded that this is also a bodily disease. You know, I recently went to Sister Ignatia's funeral. And in a very real sense, it was a time not for mourning, but of rejoicing that God had been so good to us all. And there, as the mind's eye turns back to those early days, we can see Dr. Bob, the representing medicine and AA, and Sister Ignatia, all the best in religion. Again, it was the divine synthesis of which this group, in my belief, are the special inheritors. In the middle of the 19th century, a new means of communication burst upon the world to set in motion a train of events of consequences that even now cannot be reckoned. This was the telegraph. It is a matter of great significance and meaning, at least to us, that the first words sent over the first wire between Washington and Baltimore were these. And they apparently characterized the inventor. The words were, "What hath God wrought?" So today, over a retrospect of 30 years, we are watching the building of a new means of communication, characterized not by material things, but a new way of speaking the language of the heart, one to another. And this language is a varied language, and we have participated in one of its magnificent variations. In this meeting, having in it these components of science and of the spirit, the only synthesis of any great promise to the world of our time. In a sense, I suppose our beginnings are infinite ages old, because there has never been any age in which the impulse to reach for a higher power was absent since man became conscious. Then came Carpenter. And of course, we are in his tradition and teaching. But I would like to pinpoint, in terms of people, who the personal candle bearers were in the beginning. And I am happy to say, especially so, since we have heard so much good-natured, and perhaps not so good-natured, derogation of psychiatry, that this man happened to be a psychiatrist. And in the view of many of my mind, one of the great figures of our generation. I speak of Carl Jung, one of the three founders of the modern art of depth psychology. He was distinguished from the other founders in that he felt, and I am sure knew in his inner heart, that man was something more than a modicum of intelligence often ill-used. He was something more than a bundle of instincts, something more than $2 worth of chemicals. I'm sure of this because I know people who have been in contact with him. And one of my chief regrets is that a correspondence that we had begun before his death had not been started years earlier. So vision, if you will, a prominent American businessman, who I shall call Roland. Roland was the typical case. He had exhausted every resource that he knew. So he came to Carl Jung, and they spent a year together. And Roland became convinced that now so many of the hidden springs of his strange compulsions and motivations stood revealed, that he would drink no more. Leaving the doctor, he was drunk within a month. To him, this was a ghastly experience. This was the end. And he came back to Dr. Carl and said, Carl, you were my court of last resort. Is there anything else? And this very kind old gentleman said, Roland, I thought that you might have been one of those rare cases in which my art might help you to sobriety and better things. But now I know your case is that of such gravity and complication that my art will not unravel it. And the patient took another dive toward deflation at depths, the basis on which our whole recovery rests. He hit bottom. But he persisted, Doctor, is there no other recourse for me? And the dear old gentleman said, Roland, yes, there may be, but I must be frank with you. It doesn't happen too often. I speak to you of a conversion experience. Oh, but I said, Roland, I used to be a vestryman in the church. My faith has still not left me. But this hasn't worked. Jung said, I am talking about something that goes beyond faith. I am talking about a transforming experience in which the recipient, as a gift, appears to undergo a motivation change that cannot be accounted for by simple faith. By environment, by motivation, by association. These profound changes seem to transcend the sum of all of the ordinary resources that can be brought to bear. Now he said among alcoholics, as among other men of all time, these profoundly transforming experiences have occurred here and there. We cannot tell to whom or when the lightning of providence will flash. So I suggest that you immerse yourself in a religious atmosphere, remembering your personal helplessness, and pray for God's will. So that is a word picture of the colloquy that took place between these two men about 1932. And this great and humble man had placed the first candle, which was to illumine the table. One of the founders of the Oxford group that old time. And Sam was then also rector at an Episcopal church that stood at 23rd Street, New York. And in the Oxford groups, there were a handful of drunks who had been released. Most of them, rather temporarily, but genuine release, nevertheless. And Roland bethought himself of an old school friend. This school friend is the one so affectionately known to us as Evie. Now I'll pause here, having illustrated to you this stream of influence, beginning with Jung, to the O.J., to Hazard. And let's come down on the other tank and see what happened at the confluence. I've gone the route. The story's old to you. You've read it. I told you a thousand times the story of my drinking. So I shall quickly bring myself to that day in 1934, midsummer, when another physician was speaking. Dear old Dr. Silkworth, who certainly will be known in our annals as a medical saint for so long as they shall last. Someone runs through a grapevine piece about him, and the title was this, The Little Doctor Who Loved Drunk. And from the point of view of the rationalist and the scientific man, the little doctor was a nobody. Even crank with odd ideas. He said that sure, there is a lunatic compulsion to drink. Certainly, true enough. No doubt it may have psychological causes, trauma and youth, etc. But he said, I think that there is a big moral question here. And he also said, I believe that there is something wrong with the body and the metabolism of alcoholics. For short, not knowing what it is, I use a widely understood term called an allergy. So this adds up to a compulsion that condemns the victim to drink against his will and interest until the destruction is complete. And this is joined to a physical condition that ensures his lunacy and finally his demise. On this hot summer night, this dear little man, who up to then had worked in drying out joints, finally Towns Hospital where I used to go, with perhaps 25,000 drunks, occasional successes here and there. He worked on a pittance. He boarded in the place. He had a room upstairs. So, as gently as he could, he told Lois what the score was. Just like Jung speaking to Roland, he said, when Bill came here, he clearly wanted so desperately to stop. That I thought he might be one of the few. But I'm afraid that I must say that he isn't. He's beginning to be deteriorated. I'm afraid if he would remain sane or even live long, that he will have to be committed. So this is sense. That science in the persons of Dr. Jung and of Dr. Silkworth passed upon me, upon all of us, and both these truly great men, great human beings, had had the courage to say what they believed. Well, meanwhile, my friend Abby had got into such a state that he was about to be committed for lunacy at a state institution in Vermont where the family had sung. Town fathers and wearies of Abby. For the town fathers, this was it. So they gathered up Abby, hailed him before the judge down at Bankton, and just as he was about to be routed to the host jail at Brattleboro, then appeared Hazard, along with a couple of other drunks from the Oxford group. And they took Abby into tow, and they got him sort of indoctrinated on the desirability of honesty, restitution, helping other people, prayer, and so forth. They brought him down to New York. Well, just after leaving the hospital, I had stayed sober for a month or two, out of sheer fear, constant vigil. And then I was in the toils again. So about the time Abby landed in New York and was parked because he was penniless in Calvary Mission, I'm sitting at the kitchen table. Lois is working in that department store. I had a communication, a kind of a language of the heart, with the delicatessen up there, which supplied me with gin on credit. And I sat drinking and the telephone rang. And now I knew that this was it. Something told me so, and science
I'd driven in the last fight. I was nailed down to stay. So the telephone rang, and here's Eddie. I thought he had gone to the booby hatch. I said, come on over. We'll talk about the good old days. Ah, what a very significant line. The good old days. Today was unbearable, and there would be no future. So we would call. He appeared in the doorway. At once I sensed something indefinably different about it. He came in. He sat at this kitchen table in the basement. On it I had a big pitcher full of gin with a little pineapple juice sloshed in so as to suggest cocktails instead of the straight stuff when Lois got home from the store. So I set out the tumbler for him and started to pour. He said, no thanks. What? No thanks. Well, what's got into you, Abby? Not drinking? Well, he says, I'm not drinking today. Well, I said, come, let's have it. What's happened? Well, he looked at me and he said, I've got religion. Well, if I'd been deflated by the scientists, this really let me down to the middle of the earth. Because I had had a wonderful scientific education, too. Just like our last speaker, I knew better. Well, one must be polite, so I said to Emmy, what brand is it? And he said, I wouldn't exactly call it a brand. And then, being very careful to avoid the aggressive evangelism of the Oxford groups, he merely told me his story, how he'd met Hazard, come to New York, and he felt unaccountably released from this desire to drink. Well, this release was a new one. I always talking about the water wagon. So, his story carried great conviction to me. Over this identification, no doubt at great depths, over which simple ideas could be pitched in, instead of having to use the corkscrew of the psychiatrist at the top, he was able to go right straight through. He hadn't presented me with a single new idea, though. But I will say that after that conversation, I could never be the same man again. And so, without pressuring me at all, he took his leave, said, I'll see you later. In no waking hour in the days that followed, there could be vision of Abby speaking across that table, leave me. And, of course, I felt trapped. I said, but if I only could go along with this. Honestly, yes, you could make a try. Helping other people, dandy. You know, I'm probably spirited, etc. With the God bit. Oh. And this had a really, although he had played it down, appeared to be the crux of it. So finally, one morning after Lois had gone and I'd got partly tanked up, I said, I've got to get a clear look at this thing. So I arrived up at Towns Hospital, half-sued. Dr. Silkworth looked at me sadly. And I brandished the bottle and yelled, Doc, this time I got something. And the old man said, I'm afraid you have. You better get upstairs and go to bed. Well, you know the rest of the story. I fussed around New York with drunks. The experience had a certain paranoid component. I was prone to grandiosity. I think I announced during the first 6 months I was going to fix all the drunks in the world, which was a long departure from the experience. Ego came back. There wasn't the damn one got fixed until I arrived in Akron And here was dear Dr. Bob. And so I said, I'm going to quit preaching. I'm going to quit demanding that these people have an experience like mine. Indeed, and this was another cornerstone, if I am to stay sober myself, for I had been disconcerted by the failure of a business deal, I need this other alcoholic drunk or sober voice than he could ever need me. So we struck that mutuality. I got off of my pedestal. It clicked. Soon after, there was a third. And in Akron, Bob was Sister Ignatia. Again, in this benign synthesis, medicine, religion, and our own experience launched a set of transformations running through 5,000 drunks at Akron in Bob's lifetime, and with Ignatia and co-workers in the area, to another 10,000 up to the time of her death. Such is our debt to medicine. Such is our debt to the Christian teaching. Such, my friends, is our debt to the everlasting and eternal God.
I will now like to play for you one of my favorites. Before we continue with Dr. Bob and Sister Ignatius.
No secret what God can do, what he's done for others, you do for you. With his arms wide open, he'll pardon you. It is no secret what God can do. The chimes of time ring out the news, another day is through. Someone slipped and fell. Was that someone you? You may have longed for.